Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Ellen Brown. We're going to be discussing her recent article about raining money on Main Street, and also her article on Donald Trump, some of the topics regarding the election, including both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, and some of the recent events she has spoken at. Ellen, it's great having you back on.
Oh, thanks, Robert. Good to be talking to you.
And I'm also joined with my co-host, Charles Lincoln.
Hi, Robert. How's life in Santa Barbara?
Pretty much the same as the last time you asked me.
Well, you said you're having some interesting weather. That's almost unheard of for California to have weather.
Yeah, we are getting some weird weather, like tropical, like humidity and thunder and lightning. But, I mean, the weather is pretty much the same as it is down in L.A.
Well, the political weather so far is pretty dull. So let's see if Ellen can give us some lightning on that.
So, Ellen, you spoke at several different events. One of them, well, let's talk about the one in Basel, Switzerland. That sounds the most interesting.
I didn't speak at that one. I just attended that one. It was very interesting, and I spoke at three others, so I was gone for 5 weeks, a long trip. One in Berlin, one in Basel, one in Ohio. It was in Denison. It was at Denison University in Ohio, and one in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, which was pretty interesting. It was in elaborate building where the Bretton Woods meeting was in 1944, the Bretton Woods summit, out of which we got the whole monetary system that we used until 1971 when we went off the gold standard. But anyway,
was the gold standard a subject of the conference or just a coincidence?
It wasn't about the gold standard, but it was definitely about monetary reform. That it was sort of an auspicious place because they were thinking about monetary reform before, in 1944 it was all about reform at the international level, in exchange rates and this one was largely about public banking, and there were different cultures there. There were indigenous people from Canada, had a large group of them, and some people from the South, African Americans, and so it went on for 6 days. Although we weren't there, I was only there for 2 days, but it was quite a bit of sort of ceremonial ritual type thing, which is it's pretty interesting. But I spoke on public banking, of course, as always.
Was the one in Berlin on monetary reform as well?
Yeah, it was a group of. It was actually more like, I think maybe they called it a workshop. I mean, there were only 20 people, and they were professors and community currency people and open source computer people and two conventional. I'm in the conventional category because I'm still working with conventional money, meaning, the national currencies. So there was a professor from England, Mary Miller, who she's actually friends with the advisor of Jeremy Corbyn in England. So she was quite excited about the fact that Jeremy Corbyn just got elected as Labour leader. Well, he was totally a dark horse. He came in running number 7 or something like that. But he has this policy this platform that you should use QE for the people, it was called. So, but he's actually would be using quantitative easing for infrastructure. And but anyway, so quantitative easing for infrastructure. And so Mary Miller was. I interviewed her for my radio program after that, and she's writing a book, and she had a lot of really interesting stuff to say. So our theory was that you could solve these problems on the national level with something in the nature of quantitative easing, something like a national dividend. So here are these young people who want to give away their skills. They want to do open source software, and they're making great progress at it. And a lot of the software had to do with money systems, you know, how you could integrate different community currency systems, for example. There was one man that was his project. But they want to give their work away, and of course, somehow they need to be supported. They need to be fed. And there were people from eco-villages there who, the eco-villages are really struggling as well. They do get some payment, and they have community currencies, but the trouble with community currencies is you're just dealing with what your community has to offer, and what do you do about all those other bills and things you want to buy that can't be made in your community. You need some form of money for that, which means you need to work outside the system, or you need something like a national dividend. So my thought, and Mary Miller's and Jeremy Corbyn's and is it Michael Murphy? I forget his economic advisor, Richard Murphy, think you could do it with something similar to quantitative easing, although that's sort of a misnomer, because the quantitative easing that we have, that our Federal Reserve does, and that, you know, the ECB does in Europe and so forth, that there are several countries that are doing it, is really just an asset swap. So that for example, the Federal Reserve buys governments' treasuries, or they were buying mortgage-backed securities from the banks. So, but it all happens in the reserve accounts of banks. And so either they have cash or they have the securities, but nothing really changes in the real economy, because that money doesn't get spent into the real economy. What's in the reserve account stays in the reserve accounts. But what Jeremy Corbyn is talking about would be actually spending the money, basically giving the money to the government to spend on infrastructure. But you could do it numerous ways. You could give the money to the government to spend on a national dividend, which would be something like a credit card or a debit card that you would give to everyone. By my calculations, you could give everyone $1,000 a month, and you would not cause inflation. You would just stimulate the economy and stimulate productivity. And you would stimulate purchases and sales, or GDP, all of which gets taxed. And you would increase the velocity of money. So a dollar spent, like if you just created a dollar out of nothing and you spend it into the economy, in a good economy, that money will change hands 7 times. The average tax rate on the whole GDP is about 25%. So you really only have to change hands 4 times to get the money back in taxes.
So basically, what you're talking about is, it's also been called social credit. So it's not giving people a citizen's dividend based out of the existing government revenue that comes from tax revenue. It's basically, instead of creating money through the Federal Reserve and loaning it to big banks.
Actually, what you would do is the Treasury, the way I would see it, is the Treasury would just print up credit cards and issue them and put $1,000 on every one of them. And, you know, $1,000 a month, but in some way it could be only used for goods and services. You're not allowed to speculate with it, et cetera. That would, you know, that's one possibility. So where does the money come from? It's just like they do any credit card. It's just a credit limit on your card. It doesn't come from anywhere. In other words, it's created by the Treasury itself. Or you could create it, have the Federal Reserve create it. You know, and one thing that I think is really innovative is Ecuador is now having individuals can have bank accounts with the central bank, which is what I think the whole system should be. It should be one big community currency system, essentially. So you have the central bank, which is capable of creating money out of nothing. People can take out loans, which are basically advances against their own credit. They're just taking out, you know, they're going into overdraft on their own account. And but the money comes from nowhere. It's just numbers. It's just like you've got minus X in your account, and then you have to work and pay it back. So it's like that, which is how a community currency system works. There's nobody creates the money, or I mean, you don't have to go to get dollars from somebody. Well, if it's a digital community currency system, you create it yourself when you and another participant want to do a trade.
So you're
like,
saying, hypothetically, an individual community, like, say, one of these eco-villages could do this, or would people have to depend on, say, the U.S. government?
Well, they can do it, and they are doing it in individual communities, but the trouble is it's very limited. You can only trade what you have in your community. There's no way to get those other big things that you really need to live. But I
it's
think
basically,
the idea
basically
would
a
be
problem of what they might call foreign exchange.
Yeah, the foreign exchange would be between different communities. But it seems to me that you could make that all one big system, like one big national system. Now that we know, now that the Bank of England has admitted that banks do not lend their depositors money, contrary to popular belief, they actually create the money they lend on their books. So basically all they're doing is giving you an advance against your own account. You put in your mortgage on one side of the books, so they know where they're going to get the money if you don't pay up. And then they give you an advance of credit, and then you pay that back plus, you know, as much again over 30 years. And that's how the whole system works.
So you're saying the private, how does it work? So you're saying these private banks produce the money themselves and they loan it to you on top of that? The way you want it to work is people would get, the money would be created through the people, and then people could, from there, people could decide what to do with it. The Federal Reserve, there's a lot of discussion about that. A lot of people say it's a private bank, or it's a sort of semi-private entity. But how does it work with the Federal Reserve? So they print out the money, and then do they loan the money to these big banks, or do they just give it to them?
Even the Bank of England that created the system admits that there are no such things as loans. There is only credit origination. It's all basically magic. It's spinning straw into gold, if you will. I was just inserting that, emphasizing the point that there are no such things as loans, and nobody really has any. There's no wheat in the warehouse that's being given out to farmers, basically. It's all digital creation of numbers out of air, right?
Yeah. So what the banks create the money, and it go, well, let's say you take out a mortgage. You go to the bank and you say, I want to borrow $500,000 for a mortgage. They put your mortgage on one side of their books as an asset to themselves, and then they put it on the other side of their books as a liability to themselves, because they're going to have to cover that check when you pay your seller. So you write a $500,000 check, and it goes into another bank. So now that bank has $500,000 in excess reserves, and the first bank is short $500,000 in reserves. So the first bank can borrow back that $500,000 from the other bank at 0.25%, and has lent it out at, let's say, 5%, and then they keep the spread, and that's how banking works. You're trying to get in $500,000 in order to balance your books. But if that doesn't work, you can borrow it from another bank. But the $500,000 you might get in as a check could have come from another bank that did the same thing. They just created $500,000 as a mortgage. So that's how the whole system works, that these things float back and forth. It's kind of like a community currency system. One party gets the credits, and the other party is debited the credits, or gets the debits. And then it all balances out. And if there are not enough reserves to balance everybody's books, then the Federal Reserve will step up and will create more reserves. And they'll do that in order to maintain the interest rate that they want to maintain, which to me is, I don't know why, I don't think they should even try to maintain an interest rate. Let it go to zero if it wants, that's fine. But that's what they do. They want to set this floor at 0.25% or something. and that's why they will always step up and create the extra reserves needed to keep that whole system at that rate.
Well, I think that has something to do with the conflict between a putatively public bank and a practically private bank, right? I mean, that's the internal contradiction of the Federal Reserve System, right? That interest rate is to satisfy private investors, isn't it?
Well, it's not much of an interest rate. 0.25% isn't much, but they think they're keeping control somehow by being able to manage the interest rate. But in fact, the interest rate does not control the money supply, as has been demonstrated for decades. Another conference I went to, the one in Ohio, was a group of, they were professors, and they were MMTers, Modern Monetary Theory, and a couple of them said the natural interest rate is zero. There's no reason to prop it up at 0.25%. But the Fed just wants to keep control, and that's how they purport to be keeping control. That's their theory. I mean, their whole theory is wrong, and we all think each other's theories are wrong, but I think I'm not totally in line with the MMTers either, because they seem to think the Fed is part of the government, and But it seems to me it's a big difference whether the Federal Reserve has the power to issue money or whether the Treasury has the power to issue money. I think it should be the Treasury.
So in your article, where the time for nuclear option, raining money on Main Street, you list a lot of problems could be solved by this citizen's dividend you're talking about. And you're saying that if we were to do this, first of all, no public debt would be issued, so this would fix a lot of our deficit problems. It would prevent increases in taxes. It would provide better public services, such as better schools, better healthcare. I mean, that sounds excellent, but can you go into detail about how this would lead to all these economic improvements, like no more bailouts, more jobs, no more deficits, no need to raise taxes?
Mm-hmm. Well, you could. There are different ways you could do it. But let's say, I would argue, and I was about to write on this if I get time, but that you could solve. Right now, we're at a debt ceiling crisis, as we are routinely, and they always lift the ceiling, which is they shouldn't even have a debt ceiling, but they do ever since the 1920s when they were trying to put a brake on Congress, I guess. So every time this comes around, we have to argue about it, and then the conservatives use that as leverage to get totally unrelated things passed. They say, okay, we'll lift it, but only if you agree to get rid of, you know, Planned Parenthood or something that has nothing to do with anything. So now we're up against the debt ceiling again. So you could fix that by just paying off the debt. Now, how would you do that? Do it with quantitative easing. So we have an $18 trillion debt. All you have to do is have the central bank buy all those bonds. $18 trillion, you just set out, I mean, it's all digital anyway, so you just send out a notice saying we're recalling those bonds. They've actually done this before. Interest rates were at 12% in, I think it was like 2005 or something. It was quite a while ago. 2004 maybe, and so they sent out a notice saying we are calling in your bonds because interest rates are, you know, that's too high for now, and so you can buy them again if you like at whatever percentage. But what they did was in the people's accounts who had these bonds, like it was in Treasury Direct, I think. So you've got your bonds in a digital account before you had, say, whatever, $1,000 in bonds. Now you've got $1,000 in cash. And so instead of having a savings account, you've got a checking account. You've got the same amount of money. Of course, you had the interest that you had accrued, but you're not going to get interest anymore. That's the difference. But you switch all these bond accounts from savings accounts to checking accounts. The money's still there. If they were hoarders and, you know, saving their money, the fact that you drop their 0.25% interest rate to zero is not going to make them rush out and spend that money. It's not going to change the money in the circulating economy at all. I mean, I have money that's I have quite a bit of money in cash now because things are, you know, people don't know what to do with their money. I mean, they're, you know, everybody's nervous about anything. Like bonds could go bad, stock market could go bad, gold and silver aren't good investments anymore. So a lot of people are recommending to put your money in cash. Well, does that mean you're going to go out and spend that cash? No, you just hold it there in cash, the same as you were holding it in wherever it was. So you could pay off the whole debt. You would not change the available money supply at all because those bonds are totally liquid. I mean, if you needed the money, you could easily cash out your bonds. The reason they have them in bonds is they don't want the money right now. They want to save it. So I think you could do that, and you wouldn't even create inflation. And it would just be such a cleaner deal to acknowledge that is our money supply. The bonds are our money supply. If we didn't have any bonds, if we didn't have any debt, we wouldn't have any money supply because the only way that money can come into existence today is through debt. We don't allow the Treasury to just issue it directly. So just buy all the bonds back and say, now we're going to start dealing with U.S. notes, you know, actual greenbacks, actual Treasury government-issued money. And if prices do start to go up at some point, the Treasury issues too much money, then you pull it back with taxes. That's the natural way to rebalance the system. Instead of doing bonds and then paying them off, you do taxes. You do issue the money first, and when it becomes inflationary, then you pull it back with taxes. Or there are other ways to pull it back.
The Treasury could include closing the tax loopholes because there's a $21 trillion or more in hidden offshore tax havens that are set up. So setting up a system of public banks would return the interest on loans to the government, and it would eliminate a lot of those tax havens that private banks have.
Right, there's that. But just setting up public banks would also return money to the government because the interest would become government income rather than private bank income. So it would go back to the center.
Do you see it as necessary to default on the debt? I know in the way that Iceland
has. No, not at all. Pay it off. You do not need to default. Pay it off with quantitative easing.
Could you define quantitative easing for us?
Well, or in other words, allow the lender of last resort, the central bank, to just print the money. But you don't have to print it. You know, you just issue. You just do it digitally. Instead of having bonds in your account, you now have dollars. So you pay off you call the bonds. But corporations do that all the time. They call in bonds and say, I know somebody who had his money and he had like $700,000 and he had it invested in bonds. And I think at one point he was making 12%, and that was enough to live on he expected he would, you know, have enough to live on forever at that. But they kept calling him in, and now they're down to, you can't even get 5% bonds anymore. So the fact that you've got a 30-year bond doesn't necessarily mean it'll go for 30 years. They can recall them. So the federal government could do that, and they have done it before.
When was the last time they did that?
Well, I know they did it in 2005 because I wrote an article about it, because when I read that, I thought, far out. I mean, that was obviously they can do it because they've done it. So I don't know how many times they've done it, but I know they did it at least once because I wrote about it.
What kind of action does it require? I mean, does it require a special act of Congress or
No, it was just the Treasury just did it. They just declared that they were recalling these bonds.
How does that interact with the concept of the 14th Amendment that the debt of the United States shall not be questioned? I mean, isn't canceling bonds sort of undermining the debt of the United States?
I thought that meant that you don't. If the U.S. owes something, then it pays it. So if you owe on the bonds and you pay the bonds, you're just saying, here's your money back. We're paying them off. You paid off the debt. You're honoring the debt. You're paying it off.
Well, but if the government promised to pay the interest at a certain interest rate, isn't that sort of giving the government the power to renege on that promise?
Yeah, I see your point, but anyway, they've done it before, and my understanding is that provision in the Constitution was about that they have to pay their debts, their bills, when due and on time.
Well, like several years ago, the clause comes into play every now and then when they're talking about the debt ceiling. You mentioned the debt ceiling, and if the United States were to go into default, whose fault would it be, if the United States were unable to make its debt, in other words?
Yeah, well, but there's no reason for a sovereign country that issues its own sovereign money to ever default, because it's always got the money. All it has to do is issue the money. It is the ultimate issuer of money. And the only reason it would default is if you have a Congress that is so crazy that they forbid the government to do what it has the power to do, which is issue the money.
I'm just curious, I mean, how does that concept interplay with the June 6th, June 3rd, whatever it was, 1933, cancellation of all debts in gold?
Well, that's another thing where they didn't actually cancel them, but they paid them off. But they paid them off in dollars.
They forbade the basically the liquidation in gold of any debts, right?
Well, but they didn't say declare that the dollar was fungible with gold, or maybe they've declared that earlier.
So, Ellen, you don't see the idea of a gold standard necessary. I know it's popular where your currency has to be backed up by something like, say, gold, silver, oil, but are there other ways of...
I think that's where we get into trouble, is to think of money as a thing that has to be backed by something. Money is not a thing. It is a flow. It is a trade. It's an exchange. It's a relationship. So it's a credit and debit relationship, and that's all our money is today. There's nothing behind it, no gold behind it anywhere. That we have a whole global network now that's all just the credit of the nation. But nations are no longer allowed to issue their own credit. Instead, they have to borrow from banks, which issue their credit and pretend that they're lending pre-existing money. But now that we know they're not, it's a big hoax. And now that we're on to them, we should change the system. We should go back to something realistic. I mean, it obviously works to just be trading credit, because we've been doing that for decades now, just trading credit with nothing behind it. That works, but we've been fooled into thinking that what we're trading is pre-existing money, but we're not. We're just advancing credits and debits. So you can make this one big system where it's like the cloud. The central bank is the great cloud in the sky, and your numbers are your numbers, and the fact that the bank can't balance its books has nothing to do with your numbers. You earned them. They're yours. They're up there. Because all they are is credits. You've earned your credits, and you're entitled to spend them in due course.
Do you see inflation as inherently a bad thing?
Well, there are two types of inflation. There's inflation of the money supply, which at the moment we want. We need more money out there, because you've got to have the money out there first. You have to create demand before producers will hire people to produce the products to meet the demand. If the money's not there, I mean, we saw that in the Great Depression, where you had fruit rotting on the ground because there was no money to pay the workers to pick it, and there was no money to buy it with from the grocery store. So here you had all this potential going to waste because the money wasn't there. So you've got to put the money out there if there's insufficient money in the money supply. Or we also saw it in the second half of the 19th century when in the Civil War, 40% of the money supply was greenbacks, money issued by the government, and then they recalled the greenbacks and they demonetized silver. So only gold was real, was money. In other words, the paper banknotes could only be redeemed in gold. So that radically shrunk the available money supply, and that we're in a deep depression.
Feasible because there's only a limited amount of gold in the world. You can't feasibly back up the entire world's money supply by gold.
Right. Well, and I think just the whole concept of backing a currency is wrong. That's where now we have Dodd-Frank, where they're coming out. I think I'm going to write on this next that they're have over-regulating the banks. They're requiring more and more capital just in case, you know, they run out of capital because they can't balance their books. They make bad loans and they don't have the money to pay it off. So what happens is that the little banks, they don't even have the personnel to fill out these forms. I mean, they're so complicated, all the technicalities, the hoops they have to jump through. But besides that, the fact that their capital requirement is going up and up means that they have to call in loans. They can't make the lucrative loans that they used to make. And so they're going out of business. So they're being forced to sell out to the big banks. And that is actually the goal. I mean, I've seen that, I've seen it written that that's what the regulators want, is fewer and fewer banks, because it's a lot easier to regulate a handful of big banks and to keep an eye on them. And so they're basically nationalized. Well, let's just nationalize the whole thing. Let's acknowledge that all we're talking about here is government credit, or, you know, credit that's guaranteed by the government. The only banks that survive are the ones that get that are too big to fail, that we're not going to let fail no matter what. And they are effectively government agents. Well, let's make them government agents, and let's make the profits go back to the people, and let the people decide where the loans go and that sort of thing. You know, give the control.
You said that policy was published. Where is it published? Ellen, where is that published?
Well, I was just reading it. It was a thing on the new rules. It's quite complicated. I'll cite it in my next article if I get that one written.
With the profits of the banks, you're talking about making the banks' profits public. Do you have an actual estimate on the numbers of the banks' profits? I mean, what percentage of the nation's GDP is owned by the banks?
Yeah, I've seen that figure, but I'm not sure. I'm actually not sure, but it is a major portion of the GDP.
But just doing that, just making the bank's profits public, that in itself could take care of most of the nation's financial problems with providing social services and lowering taxes.
Yeah, it would definitely help. I mean, it would certainly take care of the deficit problem. Yep.
So you've been writing about Donald Trump trumping the federal debt without playing the default card. So this is about his campaign and about his history when he declared bankruptcy. You talk about when Donald Trump declared bankruptcy.
Yeah. Well, it's what I was writing about. I got that idea. I got that idea from another, Simon Black, who had written that he thought, he was being sarcastic, but he was saying Donald Trump was the perfect guy for the job because the U.S. is bankrupt and Donald Trump knows how to do it because he's done it 4 times. And so let's go bankrupt and get it over with. So I was writing, well, you don't need to go bankrupt. You could just, I mean, it really wouldn't suit Donald Trump's platform because he actually wants to preserve Social Security. He wants health care for all. I mean, he's very, a bleeding heart liberal. And in many ways, there are many things that I totally agree with. Like, he's against forced vaccination, which I totally agree with. And he's against the TPP. Of course, so is Hillary, which is amazing to me that she changed positions on that. I mean, it's cool. Things are changing. But so my argument was Donald Trump could have his cake and eat it too by just paying off the debt. You know, you could do it with or just paying off at least the deficit, which is something that Ron Paul had proposed. So it's not a Democrat thing. It's a Republican idea. It's a more conservative idea. Get rid of the debt just by buying it back. And you can buy it back with money created on a computer screen, which is what quantitative easing is. So that's what I was writing about. But, you know, when I was at that Basel conference, it was at a university. It was the University of Basel, and so there were professors there. And there was this one professor who had come from Australia, and he was talking about Donald Trump. And he said that Donald Trump had said, when he went bankrupt, he said, "Nothing personal. It's just business," and that was the same thing that Marlon Brando had said in The Godfather. You know, every time he bumped somebody, every time they assassinated somebody, it was like, nothing personal, just business. And what this man's lecture was about was that if you're rich, that's the way the wealthy people operate. You know, they think it's just business. You know, if it's convenient to go bankrupt, they go bankrupt. If it makes good business sense, they do it. And they don't worry too much about ethics or walking over people, that kind of stuff. But they're trying to make we the little people are supposed to feel guilty about defaulting on our home loans, and they're doing these new programs where kids are supposed to be trained in, you know, fiscal responsibility, that they're supposed to pay their debts and not go bankrupt and not try to walk on it. But you know, if your house is underwater, it would be just good business sense to walk away from it and let the lender deal with it. But we're not supposed to do that. The poor are honest, as Michael Hudson said, that when the lenders figured that out, that unlike themselves, the poor actually tried to pay their debts, and therefore it made good sense to pass all these bad loans off on them. So I said to him, "So is there, what can we do about that? You know, it sounds terrible. What can we do about that?" And he said, "Well, you could organize a revolt where people generally just said, just business, you know, nothing personal, just business, we're not paying," and just all walked away from their bad mortgages.
So, Charles, you've actually met the Donald.
I have indeed, but that was some time ago. Palm Beach, Florida, and I told you the first, we were talking about his bankruptcies, and in 1992, his bankruptcy court, his bankruptcy lawyers were in front of the magistrate judge in Palm Beach, Florida, where he had some real estate, and they were arguing to the court about what reasonable expenses were during his bankruptcy, and the bankruptcy judge had limited Donald to $27,000, and he was asking for $33,000. Actually, he was asking for $36,000, and basically they came before the court and said, "Can you really expect Donald Trump to live on $27,000? Can you guess what the time unit was?
No.
Per day. In bankruptcy, no one could reasonably expect Donald Trump to live on $27,000 per day, and so they asked for it to be raised. They might have originally asked for $40,000 or something a day, but Judge Kenneth Reiskamp's new law clerk, who had never seen anything like this before, thought to himself for a second, "Wait a minute, I only make $36,000 per year." And so the recommendation that the new law clerk gave to the judge was, "Okay, give him $33,000 per day, and you know, but let's not go overboard."
But maybe that was for his business. No, that was for him personally. Wow.
That was his personal bankruptcy. Yes. And,
wow.
But it was just business. I mean, you know, he bought this big house. He bought, he bought the post, the old post house. You know, the post cereal. They had a big house in Palm Beach called Mar-a-Lago. The lake to the sea, a house that literally basically crossed all of the entire Palm Beach Island. And, you know, he bought that. He paid a huge price for it. I mean, something like $27 million or something like that. I forget what it was, but even for the time, it seemed like a large amount of money. And, you know, then he converted it into a business. It was a private family home at one point. And he turned it into a country club. So, you know, that's his habit, is making everything into a business transaction. But, you know, in terms of this this election, I was just wondering, how much influence at this stage do you think a president really has on the economy?
Well, what do you think on that? I mean, it seems to me it certainly matters who we, as between Hillary and Donald and Bernie, you could certainly see different governments resulting. But go ahead.
I was reviewing their platforms, and the Donald has basically no economic platform at all, except, I mean, he really only has three positions that he publishes on his own website.
Immigration, gun control, and taxes. And his tax policy is interesting because originally Donald Trump was talking about eliminating the loophole on hedge funds, and yeah, he still wants to do that. But his tax plan actually is lowering the top income bracket down to close to what hedge fund managers pay now. So he would still reduce taxes dramatically in the top income bracket. Ellen and Charles, what are your thoughts on Donald Trump's tax plan? I know some people are saying that it would increase the deficit, but on the other hand, he also wants to eliminate the income tax completely for individuals who make less than $50,000 a year.
Well, yeah, I like a lot of Donald Trump's policies. It's too bad he got into immigration, and it's too bad he's pro-war. I mean, nobody's anti-war these days, but even Bernie Sanders said it last night. He said, I am not a pacifist. Like, don't confuse me with a pacifist. Well, why not? I'm a pacifist. But the good thing about Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, it seems to me, is both of them are not beholden to big money. So they can both think for themselves, and they both seem to be intending to do the right thing. So assuming, even if they make mistakes, you know, they're thinking, and they can be, I mean, I think Donald Trump said that I change my mind when the facts change, which is what Keynes said, you know, when somebody challenged him on changing his mind. I like Donald Trump in part.
They're both against the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the other trade deals. I think that is remarkable because most major politicians have long supported these disastrous free trade deals, and now you have two major candidates speaking out against it.
And Hillary, which is very amazing.
And obviously, I mean, I don't think her stance is genuine, but it shows that the pressure, that the effect that Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are doing by forcing Hillary to be against it. I know Ted Cruz actually flip-flopped on that too. He was originally in favor of the trade deal, and then he switched sides, and now Ted Cruz is against it because he was put under pressure.
Yeah. Well, I think that's good that anybody is coming out against the TPP, so it just shows that the big corporations are not totally in control. Good news.
I was saying it's very close to being passed, though, isn't it?
Well, don't they have? I thought they had 3 months to talk about it. I mean, they passed the, they got it into Congress, but now they still have to vote on it, right?
Well, they passed the acceleration, right? That went through.
Right. But they still have time to vote on it, and they've actually seen the thing, and that's what Hillary said, that it sounded good before she had seen what was in it, but now that they've made it public, it doesn't look so good, and so she can't endorse it.
Also, on foreign policy, I know Donald Trump actually did call out the other candidates. Like, a lot of the Republicans are advocating war with Russia against the thing in Syria, and Donald Trump actually called them out and said they were absolutely insane, like they're going to start World War III.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. There's some sanity.
I would assume that Ellen would be, I mean, am I wrong in guessing that you'd be at least marginally more in favor of Bernie Sanders than Trump, or is that not true?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm definitely, I mean, Sanders' platform in general is much more, you know, what I would go for. I mean, I think he's more liberal and more willing to make big changes. But if it goes Republican, I like the fact that Trump is in the lead. I think he's got the most potential.
I know Sanders has actually talked about breaking up the big banks, like ending too big to fail banks.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also talked about a tax on financial transactions.
Yeah, so he has some big idea, you know, that sort of big ideas.
But I think you're actually saying, you're almost saying the opposite. You're saying that you actually do favor a unitary banking system, it sounds like.
Well, I've read, you know, both sides. If you break up the big banks, it will be destabilizing. You'd have to break them up into pretty small pieces because who caused in 2008 the one reason they got so big was that the three big ones bought up the ones that were failing and prevented destabilization at that point. So J.P. Morgan bought up Bear Stearns and what was the other one? Washington Mutual. And Bank of America bought up Merrill Lynch. I mean, they were buying up toxic banks, so that they didn't really want to do it. The government forced them to do it or leaned on them to do it. So they got bigger in order to prevent these other too-big-to-fail entities from going bankrupt, and they weren't actually all that big. And then no one was there to buy Lehman Brothers. I guess Barclays was talking about it, but they didn't actually do it. So Lehman Brothers, that when they went bankrupt, they precipitated the crash of the whole system. And they weren't that big, and they weren't even Glass-Steagall had nothing to do with it because they weren't even a depository bank. They were just an investment bank. So if you want to prevent that kind of destabilization, you're going to have to go pretty low in the scale. You're going to have to chop them up into very small pieces. And it seems to me that is not really what is wrong with the system. It's not really that they're too big. It was that they were too risky, that they were too they were allowed to be out playing in derivatives and other things for their own accounts and making money off of our deposits. So if you made it
I heard you say just a few minutes ago that you felt that the banks are overregulated and that you would, in some sense, at least favor deregulation.
Well, what I'm thinking more is just nationalize the whole thing. You know, one big system. Another thing that works very well is the Bank of North Dakota model, where you have one publicly owned bank in every state, like one state-owned bank, which is basically a banker's bank or a wholesale bank, which then partners with the local banks, which are more like the front office of the central bank, but they're like independent agents, whatever you call that. You know, they're like franchises or whatever. So they are making money on their own account, but they're like service people for the, I mean, they rely on the publicly owned state bank, which then supports those projects and things that are good for the state, for the people, for the local economy. And so the local banks wind up falling in line with those policies because that's the way they can get the partnership and get the deals. So that works too. I mean, those local banks, that's the only state where the local banks are thriving, and they actually have four times as many local banks as the national average and more banks per capita than any other state. So that works too. But it seems to me that ideally, ultimately, I'm guessing, if I live long enough, I'm guessing one day we'll see something that's just one big public utility. When people recognize that they're not lending other people's money, they're just creating credit on their books, or they're creating money on their books. Why are we giving this power to private banks? It's a public power. It should be a public power to create the public monies. The national currency should be created by the nation, not by individual banks at their whim, private banks.
Charles, I want to ask you, Charles, what were your thoughts on Donald Trump's platform based on what you've read?
I have basically no use for him at all. I mean, it seems so shallow. I feel like this is fundamentally an ego trip for him, and he's tapped into a lot of very real anger on the immigration issue. But if you scratch what he's actually proposing, he's not proposing anything interesting in the way of change at all, even on immigration. I mean, he says we should build the wall. Well, people have been saying that for, what, 20 years now? There's no wall. Then it would be an idiotic thing to do. China figured that out 2,000 years ago. You build a wall and people just come through the gates. It's a matter of the internal policy of the country, and Trump would not change that. I mean, as much as I am sort of repelled by Bernie Sanders sort of bragging about being a socialist, I find much more in his platform that is thoughtful and reflective and, you know, worth doing than in Trump's three positions, which are just, look at me, I'm going to be me, I'm going to be big and important, and, I'm sorry, I hope I'm not stepping on any toes here, but I'm not very impressed by Donald Trump, and I've basically always liked Sanders because of his stance against during the foreclosure crisis and the banks. He's got a much more realistic notion of the level of corruption, and I mean. I assume, Helen, would you agree that basically one of the primary problems of the banking system is sort of pervasive corruption and people twisting every kind of policy to personal benefit?
Yes, and the fact that you really can't regulate them, that they can come up with, their big lobbyists can change the regulations to suit themselves, as we just saw, like in December, where they managed to get rid of the last of the regulatory provisions in Dodd-Frank about derivatives. And the little banks don't have that power, so they get, or the little people, whatever, those without the power to or the money to buy big lobbyists can't change the rules. So if anything that takes thousands of pages to regulate, it seems to me, is not the ideal end system. What we want is something organic, like nature itself, something that just flows and works sustainably and within its own, something very simple. And a basic mutual credit clearing system is simple. It would be like a community currency system on a national level, which is what I believe the ultimate solution will be, but it'll take a long time to get people to come around to seeing it. And, from my point of view, I'm a writer, so it's always a challenge to figure out how to keep presenting these arguments or these concepts in a way that people see it. My daughter's thing is biomimicry, and I just interviewed her for my radio show, and she's working with all these eco villages in Europe. She lives in Europe, and she's seeing this whole underground sort of other movement of moving up from the bottom, where you have all these networks of community currencies, and now they're joining together. They're figuring out ways. Since you have the cloud and the internet and the ability to make these calculations quite simple, you have banking on your phones now. In Africa, everybody has a phone, but they don't have banks, that are buildings, but they have bank accounts on their phones. So it seems to me at some point this underground system and the the overground system will need to merge, and that the way they will merge is that it will just be one big community currency, or, you know, we'll all be one community. We'll acknowledge or recognize that just like nature works together, and they're much more, nature is much more efficient as a community working together. The ants obviously can't survive by themselves, but ants are, there are ants everywhere. I mean, they've done marvelously well in evolution, and it's because of these communities that they work in.
Well, I used to hang out with E.O. Wilson at Harvard too, and I don't envy an ant's life very much, is all I can say. And I mean, ants will never abolish slavery. Ants will will exist in slave society till the end of time. So, I don't know. I mean, what's the biggest eco village in Europe? Any idea?
No, I don't know. No, they're all they're experimental model communities. But
what they remind me of? And when you start talking about how their currency system, it reminded me of this too. Don't they remind you a bit of Animal Farm?
No.
Animal Farm is where where people took over their own society, and they tried to make it for the local benefit, but they found that they couldn't. And one of the things that they ran into trouble immediately with was when they were trying to get equipment that they couldn't manufacture locally. And, you know, that's, I can't remember what the sweet old horse's name was, but that's when the Stalin-like pig sold the horse to a glue factory.
Mm-hmm. Well, they do have...
Are you trying to go on one of your tangents and find that eco-villages are communism?
No, I'm saying that I see
well,
this flaw
that is
here.
That is the problem. I agree. That's the problem with the community currencies as they exist right now. They're too small. But there are such things as international barter systems that they're called barter, but they're not really barter. I mean, there really are credit exchanges, and they're all computerized. This woman wrote to me because she was writing a book and she wanted help with her book, but her job was to computerize all these prices for, like, she had done 70,000 parts related to lumber. So she had 70,000 entries on lumber things, like different widgets that you would use in the lumber business, because what they needed for these barter systems was to know what the pricing was in the regular system. In other words, you wouldn't know if you were getting value if you didn't know what the price was supposed to be. So you got some amount of money when you joined the thing. So that increased their money supply immediately. And then you could go in and look around on the internet and see what it was you needed for your business and order this, that, and the other thing. And then you would trade, they would order your products. So what it's done is to clear all these products off the shelves that weren't getting sold in the ordinary way, but obviously there's the demand for them. There just wasn't money for them. So by creating this mutual credit clearing system, they've created their own money. So their money is the product. And so if you're asking what backs a community currency or a credit system or a fiat system, it really is the goods and services themselves. I mean, the fiat is just a number that's showing the trade of value for your good compared to the value of somebody else's good, or that's easy. A barter system is easy. The difficult thing is credit, like long-term credit. Like, I want to build a factory and I need to get millions of dollars in credit. Who's going to give this credit? That's not going to work in a community currency system. But
the eco villages we're talking about are really small. I think it would work more as things grow larger in size. Oh, you were asking if there were any in North America. I think the largest one, I'm reading this right now, Southern Arizona. There's one in the Santa Cruz River Valley called Avalon Gardens. Have you heard of that?
No, I haven't. Sounds nice.
No, I haven't. It's well known, but I mean, they fail as self-contained communities. And,
right,
I mean,
well, that's why they're trying to branch together. But then it seems to me they still have the problem of long-term credit for big projects, and who would do that? But imagine a system that is national, but it's like national credits. So somebody, right now what they do, the big banks do credit ratings, and that's how they determine creditworthiness. And so it is all kind of computerized. They just have certain standards, and if you comply, if you fit those standards, you get the loan. If you don't fit the standards, you're out of luck, even if you're a viable business in a small community that a local bank would have given you a loan to because they know you personally. So it seems to me ideally you would have some human beings that actually determine creditworthiness. So you have a business that wants to take out credit to build something. Who's going to do that? It's still just a matter of granting credit against your own credit line or against your own, you know, it's a debit on your own or an overdraft on your own account that you're going to pay that back. So it's still just numbers on a screen. You're not taking that money from anyone else. You're not taking it from someone else's savings. You don't need to take it from someone else's savings. You're just withdrawing credit, which you have promised to pay back with interest. I think there should be interest on it, because there will be defaults, and somebody's got to cover the defaults. And we, the people, are basically taking the risk that it won't get paid back. We, the people, should get the interest on it collectively. But the community currency model is good in the sense that you can see how it works. You can see how people create their own money, and that's what they're doing right now when they take out a loan at a bank. The bank is really just advancing you credit against your own account. So that's what they do in a community currency system. They just say, if you'll wash my car, I'll give you $5 worth of credit, you know. And so you've got 5 debits and 5 credits that cross. But they didn't come from anywhere. You didn't borrow that $5 from someone else. You created that in the process of doing that exchange.
We are out of time, so I would like to thank Ellen Brown for being on, and also I'd like to thank Gerald Lincoln.
Okay, well, it was fun talking to you.
Thank you, Robert. Great to talk to you, Ellen, as always. And maybe I'll have to find you in Santa Clarita sometime.
Okay. I look forward to it.
Good night, Robert.
Okay, good night.
Good night. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.